One of them, a young woman with hair even lighter than Jago's, let us know the rooms were being made up and that she'd be waiting in the hall if we needed anything. She left us too, and then we were alone by the hearth, wrapped in an awkward silence that had fallen after Orla's well-meaning suggestion about sharing a bed. "You know, I really thought you knew," he said at last, "about her, or at least knew she was someone important." I surveyed the remnants of our dinner and picked up another crepe. I figured she had influence to be able to make those decisions about the river trip, but Ikori Princess never crossed my mind. I guess that explains why Hotsfridian is so flawless.
Yep,
tutors and such. How did you get so friendly with her? It was before the medicine, right?
Right. I helped her procure some Ivarian horses that would be pretty much impossible for the Ikori to get otherwise. In exchange, she gave me some pretty favourable trade terms.
I slumped back against the sofa, still dejected over Orla's comment about escaping my friends. Jago, in that way of his, guessed my thoughts.
You didn't abandon the others. They'll be okay. You didn't do anything wrong.
I know they're competent. I know they're smart. They wouldn't have made it through the glittering court if they weren't. But that's not always enough in constancy. Look what happened to Vanessa. Look what happened to me. I'm so worried there'll be more of that or worse. But what can I do? I have to be in Cape Triumph in 2 months.
I leaned forward, elbows on my knees, and rested my face in my hands.
That's non-negotiable.
Then that's what you'll do.
He drew me back and wrapped his arms around me. Everything's going to be okay.
Careful.
I started to pull away.
What will Orla think?
Orla already knows.
How?
Because she's Orla. You don't survive in her position without being observant.
I leaned against him and sighed. Being next to him like this made me feel as though everything really would be okay. Not because he'd fix things for me, but because I was reminded of the good in my life and why I had to fight for it. I won't admit defeat again.
Footsteps at the doorway made me jerk away, and I looked up, expecting to hear our rooms were ready. But it was Orla who returned, a handful of servants trailing her. All wore astonished looks.
"Word apparently travels fast," Orla said dryly. "You've been summoned by Shabale."
Jago jumped to his feet. "I'll go right away."
"Not you." Orla nodded at me.
"Her. But you may go along."
This drew speculative stares from the other Ikori, and I hated being the only one who didn't know what was going on.
"Who's Shabale?"
"Come on, and you'll find out," Jago said. "I swear there's never a dull moment with you."
He glanced at Orla.
"Are you coming too?"
She crooked us a smile.
"I'm not special enough. I wasn't summoned. I'll have someone escort you to the whale, though I'm sure you remember the way, Jago. Good luck."
With those ominous words, she swept away, and the blonde Ikori girl bowed deferentially to us. After donning our coats and cloaks again, we followed her out of the keep and began the trek down the hill of Kerneil. It was evening now, and the wind had grown even more bitter.
"The well is where you told the Lorandians I'd come from, right?" I asked.
"It's a holy place?"
"Yes. Have you ever heard of the predecessors?"
"No."
"Then you probably don't know that the Belanquans weren't the first people in Adoria."
"What?"
"No."
"Yes." He grinned at my shock, which was caused almost more from not knowing something about Adorian history than about the fact itself.
"No one, not even the Belanquans, knows that much about them or where they went. All that's left of them are relics and ruins, but even the fragments they left behind are pretty impressive. The Ikori believe the predecessors were gods who prepared this land for them, and they credit the artifacts with magical powers. The Belanquans will tell you, in a helpful but haughty way, that the predecessors were simply more advanced and had techniques none of us had discovered."
The information made me reel. "How have I never heard of this?"
"It isn't widely known in the colonies, probably because most of the sites and relics are in Belanquan or Ikori lands.
And I think Asfridians who have seen them assume it was all made by the Balanquins, since they confiscated nearly every known predecessor object found. The Balanquins don't do much with the ruins, though, which the Ikori see as sacred places. So the Balanquins let them set up shrines and maintain them. He paused as we stepped aside for a passing wagon. Anyway, the well is one of those shrines. It's pretty remarkable. When we reached the bottom, another Ikori was waiting for us, with a much smaller sleigh than Jago's. We climbed on and rode northwest of the city. I couldn't make out much in the fading light, but the driver seemed sure and relaxed about the way. The land turned sharply upward, growing very steep, very quickly. We continued on for about 20 more minutes, and then reached a stony outcropping, blocking our way. It stretched on, like a wall, as far as I could see, to my left and right. We got out of the sleigh just as a man and woman landed beside us, having dropped down from some hidden spot atop the ridge. Both were armed with weapons and fierce looks, though they relaxed when the driver gave them an explanation in Ikori. Then, the man who'd leapt down did a double take.
Jago, is that you?
None other. Jago stepped down and shook the man's hand.
Good to see you, Kai.
And you?
You are welcome to the well of the gods.
The man sheathed his blade and shot me a smile.
As is your friend.
Tamsin Wright, Kai Iperon, said Jago.
Welcome, Tamsin, said Kai. Jago, I don't suppose you've come to sell food.
Not specifically, but I've got a few things that might spice up your winter rations. I've got lamp oil, too. The Ikori woman stayed with the sleigh and driver, while Kai led Jago and me through a gap between the rocks. It became a winding passageway that made me feel like I was in some sort of labyrinth. Evening's shadows darkened our path, and I couldn't see over the stony walls. The only thing I knew for sure was that the ground was sloping downward now, and carved steps soon let us descend at an even steeper angle. We emerged from the rock maze without warning, and the whole world suddenly opened up. I stumbled to a halt and clutched at Jago's arm. We stood high atop a cliff, looking over a vast and very deep canyon. At its bottom, way, way, way below us, a river wound through, a little narrower than the Quistimac. On the canyon's far side, the setting sun ignited the sky with red, gold and purple, and I could make out the dark shapes of mountains to the southwest. It made for a breathtakingly gorgeous, yet also terrifying, vista.
"That's the East Sister down there. Want a better look?" Jago asked me.
I shook my head. We were about 10 feet from the cliff's edge, and even though a wooden railing stood there, I couldn't imagine getting closer to that drop. When I simply shook my head, he squeezed my hand and tugged me to the left.
"Come over here, then."
When I dragged my gaze from the river, I saw that the stones we'd walked through didn't form a straight wall beside the cliff. They curved this way and that, eventually angling back from the edge, which was a relief. One curve in particular created a wide, sheltered enclosure that contained a handful of rectangular buildings. They were constructed of river rock and timber, and bonfires blazed between them. Among it all, a dozen Ikori dressed like our companions went about their business.
"Is this a village?" I asked Jago.
"More of a camp, I suppose. They guard the well and serve the High Priestess, Shibale." I cast a quick glance back at the canyon, wondering if that was supposed to be the well. As we approached the buildings, people paused to study us. We walked past them and soon left the cozy-looking buildings behind. Ahead was only darkness, which seemed like a bad idea when you were so close to a perilously high cliff's edge. But Kai moved assuredly, and before long, a faint glow appeared. It came from a lantern hanging on a pole beside a particularly jagged section of the ridge. Two Ikori stood by it, armed. They wore woad on their faces, the blue paint carefully drawn into spirals and walls.
"They're going to see Shabale," Kai told them, and they moved aside, revealing an arched opening in the rock.
"And now I leave you. Good luck. Come find Glynn about sugar and bacon when you're done, Jago."
Kai returned the way we'd come, and the painted Ikori stepped through the arch, beckoning Jago and me to follow. Inside, we found a hollowed-out space, completely surrounded in stone. And in the center of that space was an enormous, dark hole. A chain with 3-foot links came up from the hole, went through a pulley of sorts embedded in the stone ceiling, and then disappeared back into the shadowed depths. One of the Ikori who'd accompanied us took a horn from the wall and blew into it 3 times. A few minutes later, it was answered by a creaking sound as the chain slowly began to move. A chill ran over me, but it wasn't because of the wintry air. Jago said, "This is the Well of the Gods." I watched with wide eyes and didn't realize I was gradually backing up until I bumped the wall. On and on the chain went, moving and groaning. I stood on my tiptoes, wanting to see more of the pit without getting closer. "How deep is this?" I asked. "How far does it go?"
"All the way down to the river," said Jago.
A giant sphere made of metal mesh suddenly emerged at the chain's end.
"And we're about to go down in it."
Chapter 23.
"No, Tamsin, it's perfectly safe. It's a metal death trap hanging over a 1,000,000-foot drop. It's not 1,000,000 feet.
I dragged my gaze from the pit to Jago.
"But it is a death trap?"
"No, the Balanquins made it. They're excellent engineers."
When the chain had stopped, the Ikori had tossed out lines to pull the sphere up against the hole's edge. They'd secured it in place and opened its door. They must have been under a vow of silence like the one I'd faked, but they didn't need any words to express their impatience as they watched us.
"People do this all the time," Jago said. "Ikori pilgrims come from miles away to make this trip, and most of them aren't personally invited by Shabale."
"What if one of the links breaks?"
"It won't. They're checked constantly. And this actually used to operate with ropes. It's a lot better now."
When I didn't budge, Jago put his arm around me.
"I'll be right beside you." I shook my head.
"You want Orla to help you get to Denim? Trust me, she's not going to think well of someone who turned down a summons to one of their holiest sites."
That reached me.
"You think she'd change her mind?"
"I don't know. She may still want to honor what she offered, but her clan might overrule her if they think you've insulted Shabale."
I examined the well again. Even secured with rope, the metal sphere never stayed still. It could probably hold 3 people, 4 if they got cozy. I wondered if Jago was bluffing about Orla, but the Ikori's increasing incredulity at my reluctance made me think he could be right. And I had to have her help.
"Okay," I said. At least, that's what I tried to say. It came out as a half-whisper, but Jago understood and guided me to the edge. The sphere's opening was flush with the stone floor. Jago climbed in first and then helped receive me when the Ikori handed me over. I crouched on the sphere's bottom, beside Jago, and felt my heart leave me as the Ikori sealed the door shut. They untied the ropes, and the sphere swooped out to the hole's center, rocking back and forth like a pendulum. I screamed and covered my face. Jago patted the back of my hair and kept saying, "It's okay, it's okay." It was pretty much the same way he soothed his horses. The horn sounded 4 times, and the sphere lowered with a jerk. Refusing to scream again, I bit my lip. The chain creaked as it labored to take us down, and all the while, the sphere swayed.
"Tamsin, look."
I hunched further down. "Isn't it enough I'm here?"
You'll be glad, I swear. I cautiously turned my head and opened one eye. Six! Sitting up straight, I gaped at the stone sides circling us. Every part of them had been carved and decorated. Some designs were flat, etched into the surface like one might draw on a piece of paper. Others were three-dimensional, rendered with astonishing texture and shape. Trees and flowering vines, animals of land, air, and sea. Faces, both human and fantastic. A few times we passed sections that had been hollowed out into balconies, and statues of robed men and women solemnly watched our descent. I leaned over Jago to get a better look at one of the balconies. The people seated on it appeared so realistic, I expected them to stand up and wave. Is that them? The predecessors? They look human enough. The Balanquins will tell you they are. But I can also see why the Ikori think they're gods. I hoped I wasn't being blasphemous, but it was hard not to believe magic had played a role in creating such a feat. Just one section of this, carved onto the side of a cathedral, would have been regarded as a masterpiece. To see this sort of skill in such magnitude and in such a place was dizzying. How did they do this? Jago watched a flock of flying fish go by. I don't know. The Balanquins have theories. I know the Ikori replaced the torches with long poles. They have to come through in this sphere a few times a day to do it, and it's tricky work. Maybe the predecessors had an easier way. I'd been so consumed by the artwork that I hadn't even considered how the torches scattered among the stonework were maintained. We gazed in awed silence the rest of the way down. When we neared the well's bottom, I saw an enormous crank wound with chain. It took 10 Ikori to turn it. Like those above, they wore woad on their faces. My legs felt like jelly when I stepped out of the sphere, and it took my brain a few minutes to accept that the world was still again. We followed one of the attendants through twisting halls that quickly left me disoriented. Small alcoves were scattered along the way, occasionally with pilgrims resting or praying inside. Once, we passed a wide corridor with noticeably cooler air flowing from it. "That goes to the riverbank," Jago said, seeing me slow my steps. "But we're going in tonight, not out." "What exactly are we going to do when we get to this Shibale?"
"Dunno. Everyone who comes to the well sees her. Sometimes she just greets them and sends them on their way. Other times it's more extensive."
"You've seen her then? What happened?"
"She asked me a lot of questions. Some about my life, some that didn't seem to have any obvious purpose. I assume she must have got something out of it, though."
Our guide brought us to a set of double stone doors carved as intricately as the well.
"Wait. You are next."
She had the thickest accent of any Ikori I'd met so far, but it still didn't resemble that of the thieves in Constancy. Several minutes later, the doors swung open. An Ikori man and woman stepped out, escorted by another woad-marked attendant. Ours ushered us inside to a cavernous, mostly empty room. Its walls were of a different type of stone than I'd seen in the rest of the structure. This was lighter in colour, polished to such a high gloss that it came across as mirror-like. It bounced the light of the torches around in a disorienting effect that made it seem as though the room contained more torches than there actually were. The vaulted ceiling was made of the same greyish rock as the well, but it had been carved into a perfectly smooth dome. I again marvelled at the skill to craft something so high. At the far end of the room, 5 steps led up to a dais. As we walked closer and my eyes adjusted to the dim lighting, an old woman became discernible. She sat cross-legged, her indigo robe spreading out around her. An assortment of objects sat within her reach, a pitcher and cups, a small dagger, a bundle of grass, different coloured rocks. At the base of the steps, a small pool of water had been built into the floor. Beside it was a large copper plate with coins and cloth-wrapped bundles stacked upon it. Here, we stopped. The woman, Shebale, scrutinized us with dark eyes. Her white hair was pulled severely back, displaying a single woad spiral painted on her forehead. I thought she might be smiling. After a minute, she lifted her gaze and said something in Ikori. I heard the attendant's footsteps retreating behind me, followed by the sound of the doors opening and shutting. I clasped my hands in front of me, wondering if I should curtsy. From his coat pocket, Jago produced a small jar of what looked like honey and set it on the plate. Shebale made a sound that could have been a grunt or a chuckle. When she spoke, her Ispridium was clear, its sound amplified by some trick of the chamber.
Jago Robinson, you never need to bring an offering here.
Then let me give it on her behalf, Dana Shebale. The dark eyes flicked to me, and I met them steadily.
We don't see many Ispridians in the well. What's your name?
Tamsin Wright, mistress.
Where's your home, Tamsin Wright?
Until very recently, Osfrit. Now, I guess you could say I'm between homes.
Why did you come to Adoria?
To find a husband.
Did you?
I hesitated. I'm not sure which way you mean that. Did I find a husband, or did I really come here for one? Yes, now she was definitely smiling.
It doesn't matter. You already answered. Do you speak to your gods, Tamsin Wright?
I know only one god, Euros, creator of all, attended by the six glorious angels. And I speak to them through prayer, I suppose.
Your church's creed is there is only one god, Euros, creator of all, attended by the six glorious angels. Did you intentionally change the wording?
Yes, I said, a bit taken aback that she'd known. I thought that saying Euros is the only god would sound like I was belittling yours, and it seemed rude. She didn't comment, and instead drank from a stone chalice that had been beside her. As she did, I cast a quick glance at Jago, hoping for a silent indication of whether I was behaving correctly or terribly, but his face was unreadable.
"Do they speak back to you?" she asked. "Euros and the angels."
"Not directly."
"Indirectly?"
"I don't know." I tried to think of the last times I'd prayed, truly prayed, not just following along with the heirs. My ship was in a storm sailing here, and I prayed we'd get out of it. We did. Was it because of my prayers? Someone else's? Or was it the crew's skill? I don't know. And other times I've prayed for help with a problem, it eventually resolves through something I think of. I don't know if those ideas are divine or just from me.
Both. Most visions and dreams are simply images and ideas locked away in our own minds, and we are divine.
Silence. It had a weight to it, and I shifted from foot to foot, uncertain if I was supposed to speak. I honestly had no idea how someone who'd neglected church as much as I had was constantly discussing religion these days.
If you could have any three things you wanted right now, what would they be?
She suddenly asked.
Not people, not abstract ideas like love or wisdom, not sweeping sentiments for mankind. I mean three real physical objects. What would you wish for?
Silver rue. It's an herb. It was also the main ingredient in Mary's hard-to-get medicine.
I know what it is.
What else? Pen and paper. She pursed her lips a moment.
That might as well be a single object, since you can't very well use one without the other. So name one more thing.
My mind blanked. I was too overwhelmed by being here to reason out something clever or poignant. And lately, everything I wanted was an end goal, like making it to Cape Triumph or escaping the magistrate's house. Pressured by her unblinking gaze, I finally asked, "What's your favorite thing to eat?" A very, very faint flicker of surprise showed in her eyes and was gone in a heartbeat. I didn't think much surprised her, and I also didn't think she would answer, but then she said, "Honey, as Jago Robinson well knows." "Then I wish I had some of my own to give you. I don't like being beholden to others."
"I actually believe that. Most people I'd accuse of trying to appear selfless. Of course, you've done that intentionally or not. You want each thing you named, but you want it because of someone else who wants or needs it. Someone sick needs a silver roo. Someone far away wants a letter to know what's happened to you. And you think Jago is inconvenienced, though I assure you he's not."
She drank again, allowing those words to sink in.
"Isn't there something you covet for yourself? Some small pleasure? Some comfort?"
It was so similar to what Jago had said just before we kissed. Could she know? It was impossible, and yet that piercing gaze seemed to say so much. "I'm sure there are many, Mistress Shebale. I just can't come up with any right now." She picked up a small cup and poured some of the chalice's contents into it.
"Will you share a drink with me?"
I didn't move. What was I supposed to do? Was this a test? A kindness? She'd been drinking whatever that was throughout our conversation, so it couldn't be poisoned. Unless the little cup was poisoned. If she really wanted me dead, it seemed like it'd be an easy enough thing to order one of her many attendants to take care of that. Would refusing the drink displease Orla? That was what decided it. Careful of the pool, I ascended the steps and accepted the offered cup. The drink tasted like cloves, a mixture of sweet and bitter and spicy. When I'd finished it all, I returned the cup and made my way back down. Jago watched me with wide, panicked eyes.
"Go to the wall and tell me what you see in it," Shebale ordered.
I walked the nearest one and peered into the shiny surface. "I see the torches and their reflections. I see the steps, and I can just barely see you and Jago watching me."
"You don't see yourself."
"Well, yes, of course. I thought you wanted to know what else I could see."
"What do you see when you look at yourself?"
I leaned closer and touched my cheek. The wall wasn't a perfect mirror. My reflection was a little fuzzy, but I could make out enough detail. My skin is dry. My lips are chapped.
"Why are those the things you notice?"
My reflection suddenly grew blurry, and I had to blink a few times to see clearly again. "Because I have to fix them before I go to Cape Triumph. I have to look my best. I have to be beautiful." Again, my reflection went out of focus, but when it sharpened this time, I wasn't looking at Tamsin in the stone chamber. Jago's gifted clothes were gone, and I now stood in the off-the-shoulder green dress I'd yielded to the Balanquins. My skin was smooth and soft again. An emerald the size of an egg hung around my neck, and smaller ones sparkled in my hair, which had been arranged into an artful cascade of curls. It was exactly the same way Adelaide's had been styled when we first met, and I'd been so jealous of it. Something moved behind me, and I spun around. Couples in silk and jewels of their own danced across a ballroom, underneath the glow of crystal chandeliers. The air hummed with conversation and laughter,
Waiters offered champagne flutes. A string quartet played a waltz, and a cluster of men in expensive suits gathered around me, though all of their faces were shadowed.
Has anyone ever told you that green is your best color?
I was going to tell her that.
No, I was, and I was going to ask her to dance.
You were not, because I was going to.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, I said laughing. No need to argue. I can dance with you all.
I glided around the room, moving from one set of arms to another. Each of my partners raved about my beauty and intelligence and swore he'd never know happiness unless I was his.
What will you give me? I asked them. A carriage made of gold.
100 servants. A new gown for every day of the year. A castle on a hill.
As the office grew increasingly extravagant, my eye was caught by the sight of two small feet sticking out from underneath a tablecloth. Ignoring my admirer's entreaties to return, I darted across the room and knelt down by the table. I lifted the cloth and found Mary sitting behind it in a white muslin dress, her red hair curled identically to my own. My heart sang at the sight of her, and I pulled her against my chest.
"Why, Mary, what are you doing under here?"
She squirmed in my embrace and looked up at me solemnly.
"Why won't you take anything?"
"What?
Aren't there things you want?"
"Loads, and we shall have them." I pointed at the shadowy suitors. "Didn't you hear all the wonderful things I've gotten for us?"
"You've done wonderfully, Mama, but isn't there something you covet for yourself? Some small pleasure? Some comfort?"
The words came out of my daughter's mouth, but they were like an echo. Where had I heard them? I tweaked her nose.
"Are you encouraging me to be selfish, my love? You've been taught better."
Her serious expression remained unchanged.
"It's not the same thing, and you know it."
"Why are you so saucy tonight? Come out from there, and we'll see if we can find you a cookie. There must be one at this party. If not, I'm sure I can coax some gentleman to go and get one." Mary scooted forward with me and stood up, but she wouldn't follow when I gently tugged her hand.
"What happens when this is all done?" she asked.
I put my hands on my hips. "When what is all done?"
"When we're all safe and secure. You and me and Granny and Grandpa and Uncle John and Aunt Livy. When you have everything you want for us, what will you do?"
"You just said yourself that I'd have everything I want. I won't need to do anything."
"Then you won't be anything."
"Meredith Wright," I exclaimed. "I don't know what's gotten into your..." The room darkened. The music stopped. Looking up, I saw the candles on the chandelier go out one by one, as though snuffed by some invisible hand. People cried out in alarm and searched frantically for an exit. Scattered tabletop candelabras provided the only light now, and multiple guests scrambled to snatch one. Collisions occurred, fist fights broke out. Some people gave up on light and ran blindly to the room's bare sides, groping around for a door. I scooped Mary up and held her close. "Let's get out of here." I took a few steps forward and then paused, trying to recall if I'd seen any doors tonight. There had to be at least one. People kept bumping into us in their panic, and I struggled to keep my footing and protect Mary. At one point, I found myself off balance, but no one was next to me. A rumbling filled my ears, and I realized the floor was shaking. The screams grew louder, glasses crashed and shattered. Someone who'd won a candelabra suddenly lost it when he tripped and fell. It flew up into the air, the light bouncing wildly, and then there was another mad dash to seize it. In that brief moment of illumination, I saw a spider web of cracks spreading across one of the walls. It began to collapse, crumbling away to reveal a night sky full of stars. But the cracks didn't stop there. The floor was breaking up too, and as chunks of it fell away,
So did guests and furniture. There was nothing underneath this ballroom except a wide, dark chasm, and I watched in horror as people were swept away into unending blackness. The hole kept advancing. The floor kept disintegrating. I turned and ran, but someone bumped into me, knocking Mary out of my arms. She tumbled over the edge, crying, "Mama! Mama!" I dropped to my knees, ready to throw myself into the depths after her. To my astonishment, she was still there, clutching at a broken plank that was only barely attached to the ballroom's crumbling floor. The shaking had stopped, and with it, the floor's destruction. "Hold on, love. I've got you." I reached toward Mary, but my arms weren't long enough. I scrambled to my feet and peered around. "Help! I need someone to..." What remained of the room was empty. Everyone had either fallen or found a way to flee, including my devoted suitors. I got down on the floor again, lying on my stomach. Mary still clung to the splintered board, her face deathly pale. I squirmed out over the edge as far as I could manage. One inch more, and I'd go down too. A cold wind blew up from the chasm, pushing all those fine curls into my face. I shook my head and extended my arm. "I can reach you this time. Take my hand."
"I can't," Mary called. "I can't."
"Of course you can. My hand's right there." The floor shifted, and her plank wobbled precariously. I could see cracks forming in it. "Hurry! Grab hold of me!" She reached out, but her little hand passed right through mine.
"I can't grab hold of someone who isn't anything," she said. "There's nothing there."
Crack. The board she held onto broke and plummeted off into the night, taking her with it. I screamed as the darkness closed around her, screamed as my heart and my soul and everything that made me were ripped out of my body. The agonizing pain of it tore through me, destroying me. But what did it matter? I could not exist and draw breath if she didn't. I stepped forward, giving myself over to the darkness as I fell. And I kept screaming until Jago gripped my shoulders and gently shook me. "Tamsin, Tamsin, Tamsin, wake up." I didn't recognize him for a few seconds, and even after I did, it didn't calm me down. What could, after losing my daughter? I fought his hold, even hitting out at him.
"Let go of me! Let me go to my child! We have to find her! She could have survived!"
"Ow, stop it! Tamsin, you're dreaming! No one's in danger!"
"I saw her! I saw Mary go over! We can still get to her if..."
Four Ikori burst in through the door, a small pine door in a plain room with a river rock fireplace and stone walls. There were no chandeliers or dancers, no mirrors, no Shabael, and certainly no Mary. I took in the Ikori. I took in the room. And the more I did, the more the remnants of the dream fell away. My heart still pounded, and grief still burned in me. But I accepted that it had been a dream. This was my reality, not the crumbling ballroom. Slowly, slowly, I dropped my hands. Jago nodded at the Ikori and said something in their language. They left. For a long time, the only sounds were shifting logs and my ragged breathing. Jago settled back, watching me closely. We sat on a bed that rested in an elaborately carved wooden frame. The pillow and blankets looked damp, and I put a hand to my cheek. Sweat dripped down it, and I felt like my skull had been ripped apart. I rubbed my eyes. What happened after the mirror? What mirror? The wall in Shabael's chamber. She asked me to look at it, and then everything turned. I looked around, still trying to grapple with my circumstances. "I don't know, but you were there. You must know." He handed me a mug of water.
She didn't say anything about a mirror or a wall. You took the drink and then passed out while you were coming back down the stairs.
No.
I didn't realize how fast it'd affect you, or else I would have been ready. I wasn't able to catch you before you bumped your head. I ran my fingers along my left temple and winced at a large lump. So that's why my head hurts so much. Well, I think that drink gives you a headache regardless. I lay back on the pillow and stared up at the beams on the ceiling. After such blindingly intense panic, my emotions had burned out, and now I just felt numbed.
What was it?
Not sure. I never asked. I looked back at him.
You've had it. What happened?
I made it down the steps before I passed out and fell face first into the pool. A brief, chagrined smile flitted over his features before they took a more troubled turn. While I was knocked out, I dreamed about risk. I had all these choices, and the safe ones led nowhere. It was right around the time I was deciding whether to spend all that money on Felicia.
What did we see? Is it something she does? Something from the angels or Ikori gods?
I think it's what she said. Stuff pulled up from our own head. The images of the dream, or vision, flashed through my mind's eye, and with them, the searing emotions returned. I shuddered.
Did Shabael ask me about wanting something for myself, a small pleasure or comfort? Or did I dream that too? Six, I'm not even sure what to believe now.
Yeah, she asked you something like that.
Mary asked me that in the dream, too. I rolled to my side, resting my cheek against my hand as I watched the fire. I felt drained and numbed.
I suppose you heard me mention her.
Yeah. Let go of me. Let me go to my child. I sighed.
And I suppose you figured out that your business is your business.
He ran a hand along my back.
You don't have to tell me anything you don't want to.
A log shifted, sending up sparks. I followed their flight and waited for more from Jago. If not judgment, I at least expected questions. But he stayed silent, and the longer he did, the more I felt the need to fill the space. She's an Asfrid, or was. She's about to turn 4 and is on her way to Cape Triumph with some family friends. She'll be there in 2 months.
You must miss her.
My fingers curled, clutching the blanket. It hurts so much sometimes, I think I'm going to die. I wanted to, in that dream.
Don't say that.
I mean it. It's this terrible, clawed monster eating me from within, and one day, I'm sure it's going to consume me entirely.
If it hasn't already, then it's not going to. And it's not divine favor, Tamsin. It's just you.
I didn't realize I had a tear running down my cheek until he handed me a handkerchief. Somehow, that small kindness triggered a few more tears, and I hastily wiped them away.
I'm sorry, he said fretfully. I'm sorry if I said the wrong thing, which is weird for me.
I managed a small laugh and dabbed at my cheek again. Oh, stop, or I'll end up crying for real. What you're saying is... His beautiful eyes were so earnest, so nervous as he waited to hear what I'd say. It overwhelmed me, and I had to look away. Well, it's not wrong. Believe me, I normally hear some pretty awful things when this comes up.
You missing your daughter?
No, me just having a daughter. People usually, well, think differently of me afterward.
People are foolish, he said. I pretty much think the same of you today as I did yesterday. Except now I know for sure you aren't moving mountains to get to Cape Triumph just so you can have your silk and champagne.
Well, I won't mind the silk, truth be told, but even the thought of champagne is making me sick right now, after that drink. I peered around the room. Where am I and how did I get here?
We're back at Orla's Keep. This is the room she gave you. After you passed out, some of the well's attendants helped me carry you out. Just so you know, I did most of the work. He straightened up and swung his legs over to the edge.
I should let you rest. Do you need anything else?
I caught hold of his hand. Stay with me, Jago. I don't want to be alone.
Of course.
He kicked off his boots and stretched out next to me, gathering me into his arms.
I'll stay as long as you want.
I rested my head on his chest and listened to the steady beating of his heart. As I drifted off to sleep, I tried to think of the last time I told someone about Mary without getting a shocked reaction. But I couldn't recall any such time. Chapter 24. It was strange being the guest of an Ikori princess, which was what I kept thinking of Orla as, no matter the technicalities. She'd given orders to her servants to tend to anything we needed, and if it was in their power, they made it happen. After Jago slinked back to his own room the next morning, I found a servant and asked for water to wash with, explaining that I hadn't bathed properly in days. Before I knew it, servants were in my room with a bathtub, hauling in buckets of hot water. When we went down to breakfast later, I was asked what I wanted, and a cook immediately prepared it. Of course, the fulfilling of my wishes had to fall within the Ikori's abilities, which certainly weren't boundless. They didn't have the manufacturing capabilities of the Asphridians or Balanquins, or access to a world's worth of different ingredients. Little household items and techniques that I took for granted in daily life were missing. Between the Balanquins, Osfridians, and other Avarians, the Ikori theoretically had access to almost anything, but limited means to acquire it. Their surplus resources mostly came from hunting and farming, and there wasn't enough money there for the Ikori to import on a grand scale from their neighbours. The eclectic mix of random imported goods I'd seen in Orla's hearth room was pretty typical of well-to-do Ikori. Those with humbler homes would have few or no outsider luxuries, and often the Ikori might not have things I was used to, simply because they had a different culture. So I received biscuits and eggs as requested for breakfast, but the biscuits were denser than I'd expected, mixed with flour and an unknown grain. And I learned that the gauzy nightgown they gave me came from bark fibres, which I never would have guessed. It might as well have been silk, compared to what I'd had in Constancy. Although the servants were quick to accommodate me, and even quicker with Orla, the fortress's household still had an unexpectedly laid-back feel to it. Servants always acknowledged Orla and her sisters with at least Dana, or a polite nod, in passing, but no one fell to their knees, no trumpets blared. One servant laughed when I asked if Orla had the equivalent of handmaidens to dress her and style her hair. That would only happen on rare and very special occasions, the young woman told me. Otherwise, the Dana can take care of herself. After breakfast, Jago and I were brought into a meeting with Orla, her two sisters, their advisers, and leaders of subordinate clans. We retold what we knew of the Asphridian and Ikori skirmishes, what the colonists believed, and the conclusions we'd drawn about the Lorandians. They grilled us on details and regarded us with a mix of attitudes. Some, very conscious of the long and complicated history of my people and theirs, were wary and almost hostile. Other Ikori officials didn't seem to care and were far more concerned with how we could be utilized to help them. They dismissed us to continue their conversation in private, and Orla pulled us aside at the door. "When are you going back to Constancy to get the rest of your cargo?" she asked Jago. "Ideally tomorrow, within 2 days for sure. I'll probably have to do 2 round trips, and it'd be a good idea to keep a buffer in there for weather delays." She nodded. "I understand. If you could wait those 2 days... I'd appreciate it. The others will have questions, and it'd be useful to have you around. I can send an extra sleigh with you, if that'd help, and if there is a delay, we certainly won't leave downriver without you." Jago agreed, and that left the two of us in the incredibly odd position of having free time. We had no responsibilities. There was no need to plot how to get to Cape Triumph, because that was settled. The Council wanted our observations, not our advice. We were on our own. "Do you want to learn to ride?" Jago asked me, once Orla returned to her meeting. I leaned back against the hallway's stone walls and crossed my arms as I looked him over. He'd had a bath too, and the morning light streaming through the windows made his sun-streaked hair glow with endless shades of gold. A guilty impulse to suggest we stay in my room reared up in me, but instead I said, "Sure. Looks like you managed to find the time after all." He gestured to the meeting room. "Time found us." We made our way down to the trade manager's home at the base of Kerniel's Hill. He wasn't around, but his teenage son was, and helped us get Dove and Pebble from the stables. "Father said if you came by that I should tell you not to forget to meet with him before you go." The boy fastened Pebble's bridle and stepped back admiringly. "He also wanted to know if you've changed your mind about selling these two, or the other beauty, the one with the incredible hair." Jago took Pebble's reins. "She'll be flattered, but none of them are for sale, I'm afraid. And I won't forget." "Has he tried to buy them before?" I asked Jago as I walked to the gate. "Yep. He and others have offered me a king's ransom. Can't blame them." "A king's ransom, huh?" For someone always fixated on making amazing deals, it seems like you're passing up a good one. "Hush, you'll hurt their feelings, trying to get rid of them." He patted Dove's mane. "Don't listen to her, girl. You're not going anywhere. You're going to help me make a fortune one day." I understood why he wouldn't sell them to pay his debts. After all, the horses were the reasons for his debts. Or were they? I didn't know what horses like these cost, but from all the business he did, it seemed like he should be close to paying them off. We followed a road behind Kerniel that led to the East Sister. Buildings that probably played a role in transport and fishing clustered near the bank, which was even and flat around here, and docks and barges sat on the river itself. Even in winter, river activity was still booming, and Ikori moved about on various jobs. Jago led us down a smaller track, away from the docks, to a clearing near some pines. "Okay," he said, bringing Dove up beside a stump. "Up you go." I stepped on it hesitantly. "No saddle." "You'll learn faster and better if you start without one. The downside is that you'll probably hurt a lot more afterward. Lucky you have all this time to lounge around and recover." He helped me swing up onto the horse, and I wobbled as I tried to settle and stay balanced. I clung to Dove's mane for a moment, and then had the sense to pick up the reins instead. She danced around a little, and I swallowed back a yelp. The ground seemed alarmingly far away. "Easy, girl," Jago crooned. "You're fine." Nervously, I patted her neck. "She seems okay." "She's not the one I'm talking to. You got your seat now. Your balance looks good. Now, relax and just sit there." "Just sit?" "Just sit. Every muscle in your body's working to keep you steady right now, and we're giving them time to get good at it." Dreams of galloping nobly across the plains, with the wind rushing dramatically through my hair, were banished as the morning progressed. After endless sitting, we advanced to walking and communicating with Dove's signals. Just before breaking for lunch, he let me take her out for a brief, gentle trot. It was tougher than I expected, and I struggled constantly to keep myself centered and still pay enough attention to direct her. When he helped me down, my legs nearly collapsed out from under me. He laughed and offered his arm for support. "Told you." I winced as I forced my stiff, sore muscles to obey. I'd never before thought about how many of them were in my body, but I was pretty sure just then that each and every one of them hurt. "This is the worst, right?" I asked. "It'll be better tomorrow." "Let's go get something to eat," was his evasive answer. We ate our packed lunch on a wide, flat rock, saying little as we basked in the sun and each other's nearness. Birds sang everywhere, and it was almost possible to believe spring might be coming to this land. Some snowy patches in direct sunlight had started to melt, though those in the shade remained frozen. When we finished eating and Jago announced more trotting practice, I groaned.
Come on, Jago, can't I ride? Really ride? You're the one going on about how glorious it is to run free on a horse, but I'm never going to get to do it.
You're not ready. But after a few moments of scrutiny, he smiled and said, But you can do it with me. Come on, Pebble's been getting bored anyway.
Jago untied the grey stallion and helped me up. Once I was steady, he mounted as well, taking up a seat behind me. As he reached around my waist to take the reins, I forgot all about the thrill of racing. He felt warm and steady at my back, and I wished he'd wrap his arms around me more tightly. Then, Jago urged Pebble to a cleared path, and I was very much reminded of what Jago had been planning to show me. Once he gave the signal, Pebble flew. Freed of restraints, with nothing but open land ahead, Pebble ran with an almost joyful abandon. His strong legs thundered beneath us, and I imagined them stretching as far as they'd go. The whoosh of air rushing by made tears sting my eyes, and the speed jostled and bounced us, but I didn't mind. It was glorious and terrifying all at once. After only a couple of minutes, Jago guided Pebble into a curve and sent us back the way we'd come. Before I knew it, we were slowing to a halt beside Dove in the clearing. Breathless and laughing, I leaned back and asked, "Why did you stop it so soon?" His hands rested on my hips, and he slowly slid them forward, wrapping me up to him.
"It's not good to ride double like this, especially so hard for very long. But now you see why I do so much for these guys? What it's all for?"
"Yes, and now I need to learn to do it on my own." But I stayed where I was, loath to leave when his body was pressed up to mine. I turned to the side, trying to see him over my shoulder. He leaned forward and met me in a long, languid kiss that carried just as much heat as the rougher ones from the other night. Pebble pranced restlessly, and Jago and I broke apart with some reluctance. But as soon as we climbed down, we went for each other again. As I wrapped my arms around his neck and melted at the feel of his lips, I began to think suggesting we stay inside hadn't been such a crazy idea after all. At one point, I opened my eyes and caught a glimpse of the East Sister through the trees. To the north, looming like a dark sentinel, sat the unmistakable shape of the world's jagged cliffs. All at once, the dream tumbled back to me, and with its return, all my earlier joy was sucked away. I unfolded myself from Jago and stalked away, suddenly despondent. "Tamsin?" He hurried to catch up with me.
"What's the matter?"
I pressed my hands to my forehead and halted. "We shouldn't be doing this. I shouldn't be doing this. I have no right to it. I shouldn't be out having a holiday when there's so much to do. Everyone's depending on me. The other girls are still in Constancy. And Mary... Oh, Euros, Mary's out on the ocean right now."
I didn't stop him when he took my hand again.
"Don't worry. Storm season will be done by the time they get to the Western Sea. You guys will be together before you know it."
He led me back to the stone we'd sat on for lunch.
"What's your plan for her?"
he asked. "Before the delays, my plan was to be married and have a home ready for her when she arrived. At this point, though, my goal is just to make it to the city by the time she's there. But surely there's someone left who's wildly rich enough to bring the rest of my family over and cover Mary's expenses. He doesn't even have to be wildly rich. I just need to make sure we don't have to worry anymore." Deprived of talking about her for so long, I found myself going on and on. "She's sick a lot, and doctors and medicine add up.
We've lived in constant fear. Can we afford the next treatment? Will we be choosing between medicine or food or rent? And anything other than those things, well, they were never even up for consideration. We didn't have a copper extra, and I don't want it to be that way anymore. I want everything for her. A safe, stable home. Education. Shoes without holes. Respect. That's what this is all about. The better life.